Well, we know very little, which is interesting because we have been studying this issue for over 12, 13 years now. But what we do know is that when Native women are surveyed about their experiences with violence in a national survey with, you know, the statistically significant numbers, and it's all sort of scientifically valid, I should say. And in these victimization surveys that are run from the federal government, Native women report a significantly higher number of experiences with violence than do the rest of the population. And in fact, it's 2.5 to 3 times higher that Native women experience this kind of violence when compared to the mainstream American population. What we don't know is sort of how that plays out regionally. So the numbers are very national in scope. They're very broad. What we don't necessarily have are information about regional statistics or tribal-specific statistics. And that's, you know, that we need that information in order to craft policy that's going to address those issues.
And you say it's an international issue as well. It's on one hand, we're talking about regionalization to get the correct information, but then on the other hand, we're talking about Amnesty International and broadening this as a human rights issue.
Absolutely. I mean, when I worked with Amnesty International on a report that came out in 2007 called Maze of Injustice, and in that report, Amnesty International framed the crisis of violence against Native women as a human rights violation, and really was framed as an issue of impunity. People who harm Native women are by and large not held accountable for those crimes, and the government has an obligation to protect its citizens. So by coming at it with this human rights framework, we were able to put the United States on notice that things needed to change. And the other thing that we learned through that process is that these rates of violence also occur in other indigenous populations like Canada and New Zealand and Australia, you know, countries that have tried to destroy tribal nations but haven't quite succeeded. Native women suffer the most in those countries as well.
So we're going to ask the big question, which is how come?
Well, it has to do with the legal system. And I admit, you know, being somewhat narrow in my focus because I'm trained in the law and I've been studying the law for a long time. But I believe that one of the most significant factors is a broken legal system, a system that doesn't work, hasn't worked for decades. And when you don't hold perpetrators accountable, victims are not likely to come forward. I mean, it's very difficult to come forward anyway. But if you know the legal system is not going to protect you, then it's actually safer in some ways to not come forward. So we have this perfect storm, right, where we have a vulnerable population, we have a legal system that doesn't work, and we have perpetrators that are getting away with the crime, and so they just continue to commit more crimes.
And you wrote that when you don't protect a particular group of people, predators are actually attracted to that population, so this can kind of be cyclical. You want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, it's very straightforward in a way. I mean, if you are somebody who identifies as a predator, as somebody who feels entitled to hurt others for whatever their reasons are, you know, you don't want to get caught for that. That's not the goal, is to hurt somebody and, you know, be locked up for it. It's to hurt somebody and get away with it and possibly hurt additional people. Mm-hmm. So when you don't see any kind of penalties imposed, it sort of sends a message to predators and victims as well that, you know, this kind of crime is going to continue because our system is not set up to stop it.
Who are the perpetrators? Are these Native men, white men, outsiders, insiders?
That is actually difficult to know given the data that we have. Now, I will say that in these national surveys, Native women have consistently reported that the majority of their perpetrators are non-Native. And that's a really important statistic because that flies in the face of what we know about crime in America generally. Almost all violent crime in America happens within a race. So a white victim is more likely than not to have a white perpetrator and so on. The only exception to that is Native women who report that their perpetrators are non-Indian. The challenge with using that data is, again, that it is national in scope and includes both on-reservation and off-reservation statistics. So we have some communities that really don't see many non-Native offenders, perhaps because they're very isolated or closed, so they don't have a lot of white people, you know, in the community. But other tribes that may be near a town or may have, you know, much closer proximity or have a lot of non-Indians living on the reservation, that data, you know, may be more reflective of those communities. And certainly, there are Native men who commit these crimes. And we don't want to lose sight of that, but the sort of devastating reality that it's non-Native people that women report are hurting them, and in some ways then the tribes are stuck because they can't prosecute those members, those non-members.
And those people wouldn't be prosecuted by the regular system of the state?
They can. So it depends on the state or the tribe that we're talking about. In some cases, the state government may have the authority to step in and prosecute the crimes. In a state like South Dakota, however, the states are not going to have that authority. The federal government is going to have that authority. So if you have a non-Indian who commits a crime against an Indian woman on a reservation, that's going to fall under the auspices of the federal government.
All right, I'm just trying to get my mind around that. So you're saying that a non-Native person goes onto the reservation even though he is not a tribal member. If he commits a crime there, it's up to the tribe to prosecute it or the federal government to prosecute. So we're having a legal conversation. Just help me, you know, take it real basic for me.
Sure. Okay, so we have in Indian country what we call concurrent jurisdiction. And that means that in theory, both the tribe and the federal government would be able to step in and take action in a case where, say, a woman had been assaulted. Mm-hmm. If the perpetrator is non-Indian, so somebody that's not a member of any tribe, so a white person is our typical example, if a white person comes into the tribal territory, commits an act of violence on a Native woman, the tribe is not allowed to prosecute that person for any crime. It doesn't matter if it's murder or rape or child sexual abuse or, you know, a simple crime like shoplifting. The tribe simply isn't allowed, pursuant to federal law, to do anything. So at that point, the only entity that would have authority to legitimately prosecute that person would be the federal government.
I see. And so that's where the system is falling down and is broken.
Yes.
Interesting. So you have interviewed a lot of survivors or victims of sexual assault and rape. What kind of things do they tell you about their lives that really stick with you?
I think the hardest thing that I hear is when I talk to women in the community about the rate of sexual violence, and I sort of give them the statistics that say 1 in 3 Native women will be raped in their lifetime, and I ask if that resonates with them, and almost always the Native women who do this work report that they think it's much, much higher than that. That 30% or 35% is a very conservative estimate. And the heartbreaking thing that I've heard from some Native women is that they don't know any women in their community who have not been a victim of sexual assault. So, you know, we're talking about estimates in the 80 to 90% of Native women have been assaulted.
And this is passed down through generations then. So you must have several generations of families affected.
Absolutely. And what has happened over the years is when Native women were reporting rape, say in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, nothing at all would happen to the perpetrator. So then, you know, as they're raising their daughters and their granddaughters, the kind of messages that they're sending is, you know, the system is not going to protect you. And that it's not a matter of if you're raped, it's a matter of when you're raped. And that's the life that a lot of Native people live. It's a full-time job just to try to think about surviving rape on a daily basis.
And you've said epidemic is the wrong word to use for sexual violence against Native women. What's wrong with the word epidemic? Because it's starting to sound like one to me.
Yeah, well, I think epidemic is technically an accurate term, but what bothers me about the term epidemic is that it sort of sounds like a disease, right? We have, you know, the Ebola epidemic, we have an AIDS epidemic. You hear it all the time in terms of sort of biological problems. But for me, I think we have to be cautious about the word because it sort of eliminates blame for the problem. It's sort of like, you know, it's a biological phenomenon that sort of has taken on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And what happens when we think about it in that way is it gets in the way of policy solutions. If we can name rape not as an epidemic, but as a crisis based in the law, I think we're going to go further in terms of framing the issue as one that can be fixed, one that can be stopped, as long as we're going to hold people accountable. And so that's why I've tried, I've used the word epidemic a lot in my work, but I started to really kind of question that and wondered if that was an accurate way of portraying the problem.
Policy solutions, let's start there. Where are the first steps to go, and what's changed in the last, you know, decade? So have we made progress?
We have made progress. We've had two major pieces of legislation pass through Congress and get signed into law. One was in 2010, and that was the Tribal Law and Order Act. And the other was in 2013, which was the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Now, I call these success stories, but they're also very incremental. They're small changes. They're not changes that are going to really, you know, fix the problem overnight, but we're moving in the right direction. And I think one of the things that I advocate for is for tribal nations to be able to have the authority necessary to protect women and children from violence. And so, for example, I mentioned earlier that tribes do not have the legal authority to prosecute non-Indians, which leaves, you know, women vulnerable. But what the what the Violence Against Women Act does, in certain situations, if tribes meet certain requirements, they can now prosecute a non-Indian as long as the crime is categorized as domestic violence. So we have made progress as far as that piece of it goes. That doesn't apply, unfortunately, to sexual violence. In other words, the fix or the change in the law only applies when the victim has a relationship or a former relationship with her perpetrator. So a woman who's raped by someone outside of that kind of scope still cannot turn to her tribe for justice. So a stranger rape or acquaintance rape, a rape by a neighbor or a boss or a police officer, none of those kinds of sexual violence cases can be prosecuted by the tribe if they're committed by a non-Indian. So we still have a lot of work to do. But the good news is we do see momentum, we do see changes happening, and it's really because of the Native women who've been brave enough to speak out about their experiences and you know, really push for change at the grassroots level.
So I'm going to confess to you that when you talk like that and tell me some things that are going on, I confess I get a little angry hearing some of those details of not being able to find justice. Do you find yourself getting angry about this subject, or you just dig right into the law books and figure out what's next?
I do become angry, and I will say that, you know, anger is something I talk about a lot. I used to be a crisis advocate. I'm not a counselor by training, but I was a volunteer advocate to support women. And I think that I don't think all anger is bad or misplaced. Mm-hmm. Anger can be channeled in a very productive way. And when Native women come together and they share their experiences and there's sort of that collective anger, there's an energy that comes with that as well. And that energy is really what will push activism forward. And so, you know, we got to be careful. We don't want to be bitter. We don't want to be so angry that, you know, we can't function. But, you know, finally saying this, enough is enough, right? Mm-hmm. That's really where change can come. On a personal level, I will say that, you know, just the way my personality works is that I do try to sort of nerd out, I mean, in terms of researching and obsessively going over cases and, you know, sort of writing papers about it and books about it. That is one of the ways I cope with it, is by sort of trying to come at the problem from an academic perspective, and that's one way I cope with my anger.
Do you find a lot in the non-Native community a sense of sort of incredulousness or disbelief at the severity of the problem?
You know, it's interesting. I do find some people will push back on that and say, well, I haven't seen that as an issue. You'll hear a tribal leader say that, who says, I don't see what you're talking about. I don't see that as a problem in my community. But once you start explaining the dynamics and explaining that most of these women are not coming forward, so they're not on your radar screen as a tribal leader or maybe as an officer of the law, that doesn't mean they're not happening. It just means that women don't feel comfortable coming forward. But there's some skeptics out there who say that just doesn't, I just don't believe that. I don't think those statistics are accurate. And I always respond to that, well, then, you know, let's look at some alternative studies or some different kinds of data. And they don't have anything else in the alternative. So, I think the data that we have is somewhat limited in what it tells us, but it is, you know, what we have. And so that's one way to try to educate folks to say, here, let me show you how this study was done and what we learned from it and why it does have statistically, scientifically valid results.
Talk about sovereignty in two senses. You write quite eloquently about the two ways to use the word sovereignty here in this topic.
Sovereignty is an important word for Indians, and I like to break it into sort of two categories. I think most of the time when we talk about sovereignty, we're talking about the sovereignty of the tribe. The tribe, and sovereignty is not a particularly complicated concept. It simply means that the government has the ability to make laws and be governed by them. It's a simple concept. You see it when states exercise sovereignty or when the federal government exercises sovereignty. Just a basic principle that a government should be able to run itself. But I also think, and my work as a rape crisis advocate, I really think we have to think about something that I characterize as personal sovereignty, which is sort of a microcosm of what political sovereignty is. So a woman, or any person for that matter, should have the ability to make decisions about our own lives and the things that happen to our bodies, right? And so when sexual assault happens, that is a direct attack on that personal sovereignty. To make a decision to harm somebody is an attack on their integrity as a human being. And so I like to think about sovereignty both as a political concept as well as a sort of personal concept.
I want to read a little something from your introduction up to the book. You say the most important sources for the process of recuperation are oral traditions, stories, and traditional belief systems, as well as statutes and contemporary tribal appellate case law that sometimes encompasses the traditional belief system. Talk a little bit about healing and recuperation.
Healing is a hard word for me, and I think it's because it means so many different things to so many different people. I mean, when we think about justice sort of in the Western concept, or healing in the Western concept, it's like you get justice in a court, your perpetrator's convicted, found guilty, goes to jail. And that's supposed to make it better. But tribal nations haven't always limited that kind of healing to the court system. Native women can find solace and healing through their traditional ways, dancing or beating or singing, or simply, you know, living their life knowing what their traditional values are. And I think that's what's interesting about working in Indian country, is that we do have that heritage of nonviolence that we can tap into and say, this is not always the way we have lived. And that gives some comfort and hope to people who are struggling with the aftermath of sexual violence.
How has the MacArthur Fellows Program changed your work?
Well, the MacArthur Award was most unexpected. It's their whole approach is that it's a big surprise. And so when I was first notified about it, I was a little overwhelmed, actually. I thought, well, now I have a lot of things to live up to. And so what it's done for me is it's offered, you know, some financial stability for me. I do teach law full time, and I don't have any plans on leaving this position. But it did provide me with enough financial stability that I could potentially take a semester off or even a year off to work on a new project that couldn't necessarily be funded through other norms. So I can be creative, I can come up with some ideas that might help the movement more, and that financial stability is allowing for me to think about things more creatively.
The book is called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. The author is Sarah Deer. Sarah, I want to thank you for your time today. Are there any last thoughts that you wanted to leave us with?
Just to let women know that if they've been assaulted or they're experiencing this crime, they're not alone, and there are organizations out there that will provide you with confidential services, so don't give up.
Where do they start finding that sort of help if they're listening to the program right now?
The National Domestic Violence Hotline will put you in touch with the services that are closest to your geographical area, and that number is 1-800-799-7233. 1-800-799-7233.
Sarah, dear, thank you so much for all your time.
Thank you.